From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, the first of a two-part series discussing press freedom and how journalists operate in different parts of the world. To start, we're going to take a look at a couple of countries that have a fairly good reputation for how they treat the press, at least in comparison with their neighbors. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about the world's largest democracy, India. Relative to nearby Pakistan, China, and Afghanistan, India has a vibrant national press with a history of exposing corruption and other malfeasance in the government. But under the current Prime Minister Narendra Modi, the climate for the news media has steadily worsened, according to press freedom groups. We'll talk more about the reasons why with an investigative journalist from one of the country's largest English-language news sites. But up first, we'll turn to the Kingdom of Jordan. Jordan, of course, is in the heart of the Middle East and has coped with the spillover from years of conflict in neighboring Syria, Iraq, and the Palestinian territories. In spite of this, Jordan has remained peaceful, and its monarchy has allowed more room for dissent than in many Arab countries. That said, independent journalists there still face many restrictions. Reporters who, quote, undermine the dignity of King Abdullah II can face criminal prosecution, and those who denigrate the government or religion can be fined the equivalent of up to $40,000. So here to talk about what it's like on the ground as a reporter in Jordan is Farah Ajlouni. She's a freelance television journalist, a former anchor and correspondent for English language state news on Jordan Television. She joins us in studio from the Missouri School of Journalism, where she's visiting as a Daniel Pearl Fellow through the Alfred Friendly Press Partners Program. Farah, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I talked in the introduction just a bit about some of the restrictions that are placed on Jordanian journalists. Talk to us about just what maybe one of the greatest barriers is that you faced.
Well, you know, Jordan, as you said, it's a relatively free country compared to the other countries in the region. As a journalist, I work mainly for international channels. I worked for the state-run national channel. And throughout my career, I haven't really faced obstacles because I report mainly on issues related to economy or political issues, but it's always stating facts. So I never really received any criticism or persecution because of anything I've done. But the problem here lies is Jordan is ranked as 138 on the World Press Freedom Index. And
this is an index by Reporters Without Borders, right?
That's so, right.
Okay, it's 138th out of 180 countries that they rank.
Exactly. So as you can see, it's pretty low in that index. But again, you know, we have to understand that Jordan is a relatively new established country. And the leadership has tried to build a democracy over time and establish new reforms over time. But changes don't happen overnight. And it's important to monitor what information goes out there. For security reasons. As you know, Jordan is, they often call it the Switzerland of the Middle East because it's a safe country. It's in the middle of a very turbulent region, and it's very important to monitor the information that's out there.
Well, speaking of some of that turbulence, one of the stories you worked on back in 2015, I understand, was this story many of our listeners may recall about this Jordanian Air Force pilot who was captured by ISIS in Syria and he was burned alive in a steel cage. And this set off some big protests in Jordan. I understand that you went to the pilot's hometown to talk to people there. Talk to us about that experience. I understand that it was sort of surprising you found people who at that time were very openly supportive of ISIS.
That's right. I was working with the Telegraph newspaper at the time, and we went to attend the funeral of the pilot. And on the same day, just a few kilometers away from the village of this pilot, we thought we'd go and just ask people around for their opinions. And while going around, we came across a young boy whose brother actually defected from the army and went to Syria to join ISIS. And he died there. So we asked him about his opinions and how he felt and his views, political views. And it turned out, he told me that he was very proud of his brother, that his brother did the right thing. And he was a very strong supporter of ISIS, because for him, ISIS was doing the right thing. It was establishing some sort of order. He's like, he was telling me, it's what's going on here is a complete mess. There's no rules. People do whatever they want. Look at you. You're out there. You're not veiled. You're not protected. You're supposed to be home. And he was openly talking about this. This was right at the beginning of the rise of ISIS. So since then, even after the story was published, so many rules were established in terms of freedom of expression. Anyone who sympathizes with ISIS could face jail or persecutions. And so from around this era, around that time, the media was monitoring every single statement that was said, obviously, because it was very dangerous. More and more people were sympathizing. It would destabilize the security in Jordan.
Well, talk to us about how a story like this would be covered differently between international media and Jordanian media.
Well, you know, when you speak to international media, you tend to be more comfortable because there are less repercussions of what you will say. Our stories, we post them in English and abroad. And when the stories are said inside Jordan, people fear more because they know there are consequences to what they will say. So at that time, there were no consequences. So he was openly talking about it without fear. But since people would think twice, they would even think twice before commenting anything on Facebook or on social media in general. People would... just by, you know, pressing a like on a comment that sympathizes with any terrorist group, people could face jail. So
in other words, sort of the whole climate around discussion of some of these issues has changed over the last couple of years,
definitely.
It sounds like.
That's right.
Let me ask you about another story that you worked on. I understand that you sparked a national debate on sort of conditions for women in Syria after you broadcast. You did an interview with a refugee from the Syrian war, I believe, who had been raped. Tell us about that story and tell us about sort of what the outcome of it was.
Yeah. Now, I think in terms of obstacles, I would like to go back to your first questions. One of the obstacles you find, obviously, are the laws that restrict journalists of talking openly about anything. But there's another important aspect, which is the society and what they claim is right or wrong, and in a very conservative society. Let's say...
So it's taboo, then, in other words, to talk about issues like rape or sexual assault.
Yes, that sometimes when I think of a story that could have a positive impact, I'm restricted because of how the society, the conservative society, thinks. So many subjects like rape or LGBT or...
So discussion of gay rights issues in the media is generally taboo then in Jordan?
Exactly. It's not by the media, but the way the society will react to it. I could go to any chief editor and tell them, I have this great story about this person, but we cannot publish it because this is against our norms and against our cultures and so on. So it is not just about the law. It is also about the culture in a conservative society. So this is another obstacle we face. Now, to go back to the story about this woman, this unfortunate story, it was a very, very traumatic experience for her. It was very difficult, obviously, to talk about it in the first place. So again, working for international media, that allowed me to bring up this story. And when we spoke about it, it sparked a national debate because we went into details that usually are never said. It's very difficult for the woman in the first place to talk about these details, to talk about the subject in the first place, so let alone details in that topic. So since a lot of NGOs lined up and were ready to help this woman, and if other women would come out there and speak about it, they could see change. But unfortunately, because it's such a taboo subject, that they fear of talking. For example, this woman, after all the this traumatic experience she went through, she arrived to Jordan as a refugee, and she lost her baby during that experience. She was pregnant at the time, and her husband left her because he thought she was a shame to the family. And he let her come to Jordan alone, and he went to Denmark. He immigrated to Denmark as a refugee. This is the case, this is the situation, for example, when it comes to society and culture. A lot of women would not talk about it because of the consequences it would have on their families and on them. But unfortunately, they won't see any change if they don't.
Well, talk to us about your experiences as a woman journalist in a conservative society. What are the specific challenges? Are there some advantages?
Yeah, you know, once Christiana Mampour said it, women usually tend to talk, to approach people and have access to people in a much easier way than men. And especially in the Middle East, because only women can have access to other women, you know, inside their homes, in their private lives. So this is definitely an advantage. But then, as a profession, you know, living in a conservative society, women should, according to the society, women should not go to off-limit zones. They should not be placed in certain situation. Like when I interviewed this ISIS sympathizers in the south of Jordan about 4 years ago, he was clearly telling me, you know, I sympathize with ISIS because, see, you're not protected. You should be home, covered, protected by your family and your brothers. And it was seen as something outrageous that I was out there sitting with him and asking him for questions that could be actually, could help us understand what is the mentality of a potential terrorist. And maybe because I was a woman, he felt more comfortable talking with me. But I'm assuming in this case, obviously, it's not a fact. But it is an advantage, but at the same time, unfortunately, we live in a society in the Middle East that refrains women from reaching their full potential. And the reason why I am here at the Missouri School of Journalism and following this fellowship is to prove that despite the obstacles, it is possible to grow and discuss all these, to be possible to grow and find ways of delivering information and stating facts in the best possible way.
Well, our time grows short, but briefly, I mean, you talked about some of these different sort of social and legal restrictions that you face with respect to reporting on the royal family, on the government. Is it clear where the red lines are, the lines that you can't cross?
Definitely. Most of the media in Jordan is state-run. And there's very little room.
So stories about like corruption or the wealth of the royal family or things like that, these are definitely out of bounds.
They're not discussed. But again, journalists know the red limits. They know what they can and cannot say. Now, there's a lot of focus on the individuals who went to jail because of criticizing a government official. But again, in Jordan, there's very little access to information, especially sensitive information or records. So it's difficult for journalists to come with straight facts out there to tell a story. So a lot of criticism comes also from rumors or assumptions. And obviously, we all know as journalists, we cannot publish stories out there if we don't have our facts straight. So this is why then there are the government official who's been criticized, for example, could bring that journalist to court and.
So it sounds like the journalist can be in a difficult situation then if they may not be able to obtain documents or factual supporting evidence of wrongdoing or malfeasance. they can't, right. It's difficult for them to make that story, and yet the documents or evidence may never become available because the society or the political system is closed in some way.
Exactly.
So it's like a catch-22.
Exactly. It's a vicious circle. You know, you can't get the right information, but then if you talk about what you know but you're not sure, then you might have consequences because of publishing your own information. So this is the reason why the rule, the laws are very, very strict on when it comes to criticizing the government.
Well, Farah Ajlouni, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Today, the first of a two-part series about press freedom and challenges for journalists around the world. We just spoke with Farah Ajlouni, a reporter for Jordanian television and different international news outlets. Now we're going to turn our attention to India, the nation with the freest media in South Asia. With 1.3 billion people and 22 different national languages, the situations for journalists and bloggers varies widely across the country. But generally speaking, journalists and news outlets there have been faced increasing pressures from the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi since he took power in 2014. Groups like Freedom House have criticized a, quote, climate of impunity for those who attack and even kill journalists, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to report on news that casts a bad light on Modi's ruling BJP party. Now, to hear about more about this and other issues for journalists in the media is Samarth Bansal. He's a data and investigative journalist for the Hindustan Times, one of the country's largest English language news sites. Samarth is visiting the Missouri School of Journalism on a fellowship from the Alfred Friendly Press Partners. Samarth, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, talk to us first about your background. You were a math and computing major in college, had some opportunities to work for technology companies and make a lot of money. Instead, you chose to pursue a career in journalism. Why?
Yeah, so while I was in college, I used to write software for a startup, and I really enjoyed it. And used to do data science. I was studying mathematics and computing science, so that was one of our primary areas of study. But in my final year at college, I restarted an extinct campus publication. We called it Vox Populi. The reason was that I found that there was no platform for us to discuss issues that matter to the community, issues of students, faculty members, staffers, and other people living in our campus. So me and a friend of mine, we got together, launched a website, started reporting on issues that we cared about. And that 1 year doing that reporting and, you know, building a community of people talking about issues, I think that really told me about the power of journalism, and I realized how much I enjoy it. And then totally by chance, in like an accidental scenario, I came across the data editor of The Hindu, which was my first organization where I worked, and got to know that the organization was looking for people interested in journalism, data science, and software engineering. So I thought, you know, this is like the perfect mix of my skill sets. And after I did an internship at that organization, I realized that how powerful like my skill set in data science and software engineering could be used in journalism for storytelling.
Let me ask you about how you used data to report a story there. A couple years ago, you did an investigation on the Indian government's claims about the number of people that had benefited from a rural electrification scheme to bring electricity to parts of India that didn't have it. Talk to us about that story, what you found, how the government responded to your findings.
Sure. So the story basically started with a question. So I was looking at the numbers from the power minister, and it looked like that this is amazing, right? We are increasingly electrifying houses. So I wanted to do a story telling that what is it that this government is doing different, that, you know, the pace of electrification has increased. So I started digging into the numbers. So the government of India has a very transparent dashboard online where it tracks the number of houses that have been electrified, villages that have been electrified. And an engineer on the ground enters data from the field that this is the status. They post photographs and some comments. What I found was that when I looked at on the top bar of the dashboard, it said that the village is electrified. But then when I go deeper into the comments, I said, no, the engineer says that the village is not electrified. So this was contradictory. So then I wrote a program. I downloaded and scraped the entire website of the 18,000 villages that the government said were not electrified. And I did some analysis on that, looking at, okay, this is the list of villages that the government says electricity, but here is what the engineer says. And so this contradiction is what got me into the story. Then as journalists too, I started making phone calls. There were phone numbers of these engineers. I spoke to at least 50 field engineers on the phone. What's going on? Then a reporter from our newspaper went and saw a few villages, and we had the story. that the dashboard was not telling you the correct picture. Had I not been able to scrape that website or do that analysis, it would have been difficult to authoritatively claim that why the numbers were exaggerated. So that was the story that we found.
And how did the government respond to this reporting then?
So see, because the story was totally based on facts and data, so the power minister responded saying that, we acknowledge the findings of the report. 2 days later, he said, and I've asked my officials to look into, what the story says. 2 days later, the electrification chief wrote a rebuttal or you can say a response to our piece saying that, okay, this is what the reporter says, but you should appreciate that at least the government was transparent enough, in providing these numbers. And the power minister said that we appreciate this kind of constructive journalism, that, you're bringing these issues that I was not aware of. So that is what the response was, that we'll look into it. So,
well, that sounds like there was a positive outcome then to that story. But let me ask you about some of the issues that journalists across India mm-hmm. face, one of which I understand is self-censorship. Talk to us about how that affects you as a reporter, how it affects your colleagues.
Sure. So, the roots of self-censorship, if you have to understand it, you have to understand how, the media ecosystem in India from a larger, in a larger picture. So, bulk of the Indian media is driven by corporates. And so the economics of reporting is, what is at the heart of self-censorship. So it's not really censorship from the government per se that is a problem, but it is fear of news organizations, big media organizations, to report on issues that they may think that the government may not be pleased. And the reason for that is, for a lot of big newspapers and television channels, a lot of funding comes from government advertisements. So if you report on things that you may think that the government may not be happy, if they cut ads, your revenue model.
Can you give us some examples of when that's happened?
I do not have specific examples in mind right away, but I can give you anecdotal instances that, reporters talk that, this happened with me. So think of skill ministry. So in India, we have a major unemployment crisis, biggest political issue right now. So the government in India has a big program about jobs and skilling people,
training people for new jobs.
For new jobs. Now, the Skill India program, as this government calls it, it is faced with a lot of issues. In implementation, there were instances of corruption, reporters have written about it. But given how sensitive the topic is, and given the nature of the skill ministry, that they need to advertise that, we have the skilling programs, that becomes a huge issue.
Okay, so
that's a conflict, right? You need to advertise that, we have these skilling programs, it will give you jobs.
So the papers or the media outlets will lose advertising from the job training programs if they report negatively on the job training programs. And the budget is big enough from the government to really affect how news organizations would cover an issue.
Yeah, and it's so the way to I think about it, it's not about ad on one particular day, but it's a relationship that goes on beyond one story. And also the businesses in India, they're also pretty much inclined with the government. So if the government says we are not advertising in this newspaper, it may also be that the businesses will also pull out because of this nexus.
So other large businesses will also pull their advertising if the government pulls their advertising because of a specific story.
So it's not just about government. It's also about business advertisement, which both related.
So for you personally, are there some stories that you wouldn't cover or would know not to cover as a result of this?
Yeah, so the difference between bulk of almost all my work is data driven. So there's not been a single story that I've written that has been challenged simply because we say this is government data or this is data from this source, an authoritative source, and this is what it says. Of course, people can question the way we interpret the numbers. That's in the nature of data analysis. But largely, there's not been a single story which has been questioned because the nature of the story is such that it's difficult to just pinpoint that this is why it's problematic.
Well, let me ask you about another one of your data-driven stories. You created a women's empowerment index mm-hmm. about where the best state is in India to be a woman, where women have the most opportunities. Where did you come up with this idea? Tell us how you built this metric.
Sure. So the government of India recently released a very large data set. It's a household family survey, talking about health and indicators about women in India and gender. So if you look at India, such a big country, any metric that tells you this is X percent of women in India have that does not make sense. It's such a wide and varied country. So always we look for things that can tell you things at the state level and even better at the district level. So I started with this question about that we have a lot of these indicators. Can I come up with an index that tells us what is it like to be a woman in a particular state? So I took 8 indicators that the government provided under the gender, women empowerment. There were 8 indicators, things like how many women can participate in making household decisions, how many have a bank account, how many have a mobile phone that they can use. So there were 8 such indicators. There are standard methods in economics that allow you to put these indicators together and get a score, normalize it for all states. So I put them together and got one number for all. And found that there's this belt in central North India, like states like Bihar, Uttar Pradesh, Rajasthan, which also lag behind a lot of economic and health indicators. These were the states where it's not great to be a woman in India in a relative scale.
And did you find that this type of reporting, did it spark some conversation or some discussion or change within these areas?
So I think with a lot of work that comes from data-driven journalism that we do is about to give an insight to policymakers on, you know, what is it like and answering basic questions. So it's difficult for us to really measure, you know, how people in the government are looking at, you know, these numbers. But for us, it was for readers to tell them that, you know, this is the state of the country as it stands right now. And these are the areas where we need to be more conscious about when we're talking about rights of women.
Our time does grow short. But while you're in the United States, you'll be here at the Missouri School of Journalism. You'll also be working at the Wall Street Journal for a number of months in a newsroom there. What do you hope to accomplish while you're here? What do you hope to bring back to India?
So in the Wall Street Journal, so there are like 2 things. One, the Wall Street Journal data journalism team is part of the investigative reporting team. So I'm looking forward to understand that how the U.S. news media is using data more effectively, perhaps, for investigative reporting. So that is one of my major objectives. And second, I personally think that the digital transition of the Indian mainstream media has not been up to the mark. We have gone from print to digital, but there's a lot to be done. So I want to explore that how the U.S. is, you know, going through this transition phase from going from print to digital. So I think at the Journal, that is something I'm looking forward to.
And with just a few seconds left, we mentioned in the intro that there has been a lot of criticism of the press freedom climate and by rights groups of the Prime Minister,
yes,
Narendra Modi's government here. Do you see the same thing? Do you see the same trends for the media in Indian society?
Sure. So because I've not been a journalist before the Modi government came into power, difficult for me to give a comment. But what I see from this, there are signals across the past year, instances where there have been resignations from editors, reporters. They've been like, and recently there was an FIR against a reporter who exposed the security breach in India's unique identity program. So with instances like this, you feel that, you know, what is just going on? So I think that the trust in media institution in India is also declining, and that's somewhere where the government is trying to, you know, delegitimize the media and build over it. There was a raid on one of the biggest news channels in India. So I'm not sure if it is declining as a trend, but there are signals that there needs to be more work to be done for journalists to be free and report as they want to.
Well, Samarth Bansal, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Samarth Bansal and Farah Ajlouni of the Alfred Friendly Press Partners Program. Our producer this week is Rachel Foster Kimball, and Juwan Choi is our visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.